Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. In the interviews for the Middle Way Society, I generally ask people what their understanding is of the Middle Way and how it might relate to what they've been talking about. This is the second compilation of interviews' responses to those questions. Paul Gilbert, a clinical psychologist and author of The Compassionate Mind, spoke about compassion and how he came to develop compassion-focused therapy. I asked him how he understood the Middle Way and how it related to his work.
Well, I think if I recall, the Buddha was sitting on a bank and he watched somebody floating by with a violin, and he was tuning up the violin. And the Buddha realized that if the string was too slack, it wouldn't sound, and if it was too tight, it would break, right? So you remember this story. The Middle Way is really important because it actually means that things in the right combination produced new phenomena, right?
Yeah.
So it's all to do with balancing the relationship between things to create new things. So, for example, one atom of hydrogen, two atoms of oxygen give water. But that's the only way it will happen. Any other balance, any other combination, it won't happen. That's its combination. Okay. So the issue of balance is very much about how you integrate potentially opposing forces, but not always opposing forces, in such a way that they work together to form new relationships and bring in new things. So, like within your mind, it's how do you use compassion in such a way that also you can be assertive, also you can be engaged in the world, you can have drive, also you can be anxious when you need to be anxious. How are these things balanced? Do they function optimally for the whole organism? So that's my understanding of the Middle Way.
Mark Vernon, the writer and journalist, talked about his book, How to Be an Agnostic, and agnosticism's relation to theism. He put the case for virtue ethics, and we also discussed Plato, Socrates, Jung, Ian McGilchrist, and I asked how he understood the Middle Way.
Well, and the way that the phrase strikes me is through Buddhism, I guess, the Buddha's way traditionally being known as the Middle Way. So it was neither ascetic extremism, as he tried, so the stories go, and found that didn't work, but neither is it pure indulgence. There's a kind of art to life, you might say. I rather like in Buddhism this use of the word right, you know, right effort, right mindfulness, right living. And it suggests a kind of balance that, you know, in right effort, you've got to put some effort in, but if your effort becomes too possessive and clinging and holding, then you undermine what you're trying to do. So there's a kind of easing off, a letting go as well in right effort. But these things are they're only learned when through experience, through practice, through making mistakes. I think it fits very well with virtue ethics in that respect. It's something that it's a practical intelligence, a practical wisdom, rather than, again, something which you can just read on the page.
So I
like that's what the Middle Way speaks to me of immediately.
Leslie Jeffries and Jim O'Driscoll, founders of Language in Conflict, spoke about how their project looks at the potential contribution of linguistics to conflict studies by examining the use of language in conflict situations and its resolution. I asked them what they knew of the Middle Way.
The honest answer is very little. The first thing that comes to me with Middle Way is two things. One of them is something New Labourite and Blairite and Anthony Giddens, which is Third Way and so on. The other is a sort of Taoist Buddhist thing about knife through butter and taking the easiest way because it is actually the best way, and it's always the middle way, not going to extremes. That's what is called to mind by the phrase middle way to me.
Claire Kelly of the Mindfulness in Schools project spoke of why she feels it's important to introduce children to mindfulness practices, how the project goes about it, and I asked her how it might relate to her understanding of the middle way.
This is a huge philosophical question, isn't it? I know it's had lots of different interpretations, but for me, it's about a balanced approach to life. And it's about enjoying life, seeing it as something that requires, like I say, a balance, but not allowing you to be passive about your life, engaging with it fully, whilst not overindulging. Like, that's a very woolly answer, isn't it? But that's what it means for me. And I think the capacity to, what we were talking about with metacognition, the capacity to notice your habits, the capacity to notice your responses to whatever your life throws at you, I think is an absolutely crucial part of that middle way.
Vishvapani Blomfield, author, Thought for the Day presenter and mindfulness trainer, spoke about mindfulness and the middle way. I asked him about his interest in how the more secular and more religious interpretations of the middle way might compare.
Okay, so when I look at Buddhist teachings, what I find is two emphases which operate in tandem and sometimes in tension. And one of those emphases is what I see being picked up by secular Buddhists and people like that. And I actually would rather avoid characterizing the middle way society position. I let its own members do that.
Yeah.
So this one position is one that says we need to work out for ourselves, drawing on our own experience, what is helpful.
Yeah.
What's skillful, what's unskillful. And we can test this empirically. The Buddha, for example, and no doubt others, offer ways to develop the mind, to develop spiritually. We try them out. They might work, they might not work. We make our own sense of them. And that would be an empirical and empirical approach that's broadly rationalizable. It's not exclusively rational by any means, but you can put that in quite rational terms.
Yeah.
Now, that there's something else in the Buddhist tradition, and this is the bit that gets called religious. When you see in the Buddhist texts accounts of why people become followers of the Buddha, the account starts with a Buddha arises in the world.
Okay.
So someone wakes up from this dream of existence. They see the truth of things. The point is that there's a side of Buddhism that starts with the Buddha, that starts with someone gaining enlightenment and seeing something that other people can't see for themselves. They see the things that you can't work out for yourself empirically. How can I understand who I really am when I'm doing it from inside my own mind and my own conditioning, my own narrow perspective? So then there's the aspect of opening oneself up to the truth of, to what, you know, purports at least to be the truth of the teachings that are offered with authority and which you can't verify. So even if you're testing them out empirically, there's still an act of faith. And this, to be truly effective, has to be a heartfelt act of faith, not just a willingness to suspend disbelief. So within the Buddhist perspective, there's a sense of the wise of people like the Buddha and maybe even of reality being something that is beyond our narrowly conceptual, but is not conceptualizable. And So the act of acting, of following the Buddhist teachings, or as I would say, as a Buddhist, practicing the Dharma, acting in accordance with the Dharma, which means really the truth of things.
Yeah.
That is a constant opening up of myself to something that is beyond what I can already know.
Okay.
So that is where faith comes in. And because it's not a rational process, that's where ritual comes in. That's where all these supernatural figures like Buddhas and Bodhisattvas come in, because they represent that dimension which is beyond one's own experiences, of another nature to one's own experience.
Rich Flanagan spoke about why he joined the society, his job as an operating department practitioner in the NHS, and as a dad. We discussed atheism, meditation, and his interest in science. I asked him how the middle way related to his interest in meditation and how he applied it in his life in general.
So I think related to the meditation, which I apply to my job, and also to some of the Buddhist teachings, which I've come across whilst researching meditation. I think from the middle way point of view, with my job, now I'm involved with, I currently work in recovery, so waking people up after anaesthetics.
Yeah.
You need quite a lot of patience.
Uh-huh.
In terms of, you know, patience with patients. you have people who can be in a lot of pain. You can have people who are very aggressive, often confused when they're waking up. And so you need to be very patient. You need to be certainly in the moment. It's not very good to be daydreaming, you know, when you're monitoring someone's heart rate and breathing.
Yeah, yeah.
I am a bit of a daydreamer, so I think, I mean, that's more of the meditation helps with being present in the moment, and those skills I'm able to take to the job. With the middle way, I think really it's patience, perhaps understanding, and being able to step back and view each situation as it arises. And avoiding extremes that may come about as a result.
Birya Nair spoke about teaching critical thinking as a part of spiritual practice, as opposed to a more academic focus, and the value of teaching it to children from an early age. I asked her what her understanding is of the middle way, and whether it related to critical thinking.
Okay, well, obviously this is a rich term. So for me, the middle way is very much about being aware of where you are, being aware of where you're going, what you're aiming towards, but also holding them both simultaneously. So one of my practices is the practice of equanimity, upekkha, equanimity. So this is where you're aware of joy, you're aware of sorrow. You feel it, but you're not overwhelmed by it. So for me, it's an important practice, but it's a difficult practice. So for me, it's very important to have that as an aim, but to be aware of where I am at the moment, what I can do, what I can't do, and keep that flexible feeling around where I am. So the middle way, I'm moving, I'm changing, but I'm aware of what my current capacity is.
Okay. And how does what we've been talking about today relate to the middle way?
Part of the middle way, of course, is getting greater clarity, greater awareness of where you are at the moment. Yeah? And critical thinking, of course, is a great help to clarity and awareness. And my motto when I'm teaching critical thinking, either to Buddhists or to A-level students, comes from Socrates, a Greek philosopher, who said, "When I find I've made a mistake, I'm happy, because that means I'm wiser today than I was yesterday."
Right.
And I really love that quote, because you're saying, I'm not perfect, but if I find I've made a mistake, then I can learn from it. And that's very critical thinking, but it's also very middle way.
Peter Worley, founder of the Philosophy Foundation and author of The If Machine and The Philosophy Shop, spoke about teaching philosophy to children and philosophy's wider role in education. I asked him about the middle way and how he felt philosophy related to it.
Yeah, well, I'm acquainted with Buddhist philosophy, which is, as I understand it, where the idea of the middle way comes from.
Yeah.
In fact, it was one of the ways in which I was introduced to philosophy right at the beginning as a teenager when I did a course with the late Ray Billington, who died sadly last year. And he used to teach courses in Eastern philosophy. So I became acquainted with this. And interestingly, even though I'm trained as an analytic philosopher, I have this very different background. And as I understand it, the way we work at the TPF does have a kind of middle way about it. You may have picked up on this already in some of the things I've said. So, for instance, we don't judge the children.
Yeah.
But we also don't go to the extreme of saying that there's no such thing as a right and wrong answer in philosophy. So this is kind of what I might describe as a middle way.
Yeah.
We also have a principle that we call absence, which that is an example of, where we encourage our specialists to when they're facilitating a philosophy conversation with anyone for that matter, not just children, we encourage them to be sort of present but hidden. Sort of paradoxical kind of expression, which is, I think, very much a kind of middle way of expressing things. Present but hidden, so they're there to kind of effect progress within a discussion, philosophical progress, but not to sort of step in with their own interpretations, their own views, their own points, and all this, that, and the other. So this principle that we call absence, which is seems to me to be getting at that kind of middle way. Also, there's a book I've read recently, The War for Children's Minds by Stephen Law, where he makes a really interesting case for liberal education in terms of he says, look, you know, you need to be careful that if you're a liberal and you're trying to promote liberal values, you've got to be careful that you don't just become another authoritarian.
Exactly.
In other words, you know, my children are going to grow up to be tolerant and respectful and all these wonderful things, but I'm not going to give them any options. I'm going to sort of brainwash them into this view. And he says that this is just as bad as the extreme right religious person who brings up their children.
Exactly.
So the important thing is to, he says in his book, the important thing is to introduce children to the tools and strategies that enable them to then engage critically with everything that's put to them when they grow up. So by the time they are adults, they're able to make informed decisions, not just about newspaper articles and not just about that, but also about the views of their own parents, about the views of their own immediate community.
Yeah.
And their peers. And I think that's absolutely right. And that seems to me to be a kind of middle way, a correct way of understanding how to approach the teaching of liberal values.
Don Cupid, the theologian and philosopher, spoke about how he understands religion and his non-realist position about God. He also touched on Jungian archetypes, agnosticism, Stephen Batchelor, and I asked him how he views the middle way.
It's not quite in my vocabulary, but I do recognise from what I've read of Robert Ellis's ideas a certain affinity and similarity with what people like Stephen and I are saying. Yes, we've got to work away at developing as simple and clear a vocabulary as we can get to find something we can communicate to a secular age. Do you know, in the world we've got, people understand only fundamentalism. Any kind of novelty in religious thought they find very difficult and hard to understand. They prefer ultra-conservatives or whatever. I don't know, by the way, I wonder if middle way people are, as I am, rather impressed by Pope Francis. It looks to me as if he does understand something of the fix that the Roman Catholics are in and something of the way out of it. He looks back to the teaching of Jesus and to Francis, and his freshness, his rather open-air quality, his common humanity, has excited ordinary people to a remarkable degree.
Kristin Neff, Associate Professor in Human Development and Culture at the University of Texas, spoke about self-compassion, how she felt it differs from self-esteem, and why it's such a useful thing to cultivate in life. I asked her what her understanding was of the middle way in relation to this.
Well, for me, the middle way is... it seems so trite to say define balance, but, you know, really, I think that's... that over and over again, that's what the middle way is pointing to. Not, you know, finding about balance between autonomy and connectedness, for instance, between, boy, you stumped me with this one. gotta look at my Buddhist books. So for instance, finding a balance between caring for yourself and caring for others, not taking our thoughts too seriously, and yet taking them seriously enough to be functional, the same with our emotions, really not taking an extreme position on everything, with the understanding eventually that points to non-duality, right? That, and I'm not going to give you my 5-second version of non-duality, but to the degree I understand it, it's really, the realization that things are not as separate and individualized and concrete as we think we are. So for me, the middle way, you know, some people, they just meditate all the time and they get into the idea of non-duality and they check out of life. For me, the middle way is holding the understanding of illusion, of Maya, that things are not what they seem to be, while still fully inhabiting life and living it to one's fullest. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was great. That was great.
Boy, I pulled that one. Hopefully out of the hat. I don't know.
You certainly did.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.